at WMNF.org. Thank you. I'm Duncan Strauss. Really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll speak with our guest Michael Hinkson about his new book, recounting, among other things, his singular 9/11 experience being led to safety from the 78th floor of the Twin Towers by his guide dog, Roselle. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. A couple of weeks ago on the 60 show, Phil played Spirit's Animal Zoo as a nice nod to Talking Animals. So, of course, my way of acknowledging and thanking for that is to rip off the idea. This is Spirit with Animal Zoo here on Talking Animals.
Living in the city, I've been abused. He has jobs like keeping people I need. It don't do more than make me amused. So don't look now, don't ask how. Gonna find me a way to the animal zoo. Oh no, something went wrong. Well, you punched too bad and a little too long. Hey, hey, got too much to lose. Got to get on back to the animal zoo. Hey, hey, hey. Looking at my body, I'm slipping.
That's Spirits with Animal Zoo, an animal song of sorts to ease us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Michael Hinkson, author of the new book, Thunderdog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. A spirited yarn told by Hinkson, blind since birth, about working in the North Tower of the Twin Towers on 9/11 and being led to safety from the 78th floor by his guide dog, Roselle. Interwoven with a memoir of sorts chronicling his life before and after that day. Just perhaps one of the more distinctive ways to mark the 10th anniversary of 9/11, which more and more folks and media types and others are doing. So we'll find out about his life, the book, and more when we speak with Michael Hinkson in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also a bit later in the show, we'll step into the Comedy Corner, which involves animal comedy. Play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Michael's new book, Thunderdog. And we'll hear an animal song by a pretty hip Chinese folk music band. Right now, Though it's time for the Animal News and Announcements segment, a look at items of interest in animal news, as well as announcements of local events in coming up in the coming days and weeks ahead. So produced by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department, our first item, actually just sort of a note more than an item, and if you happen to see either video or a photo of the dog at the funeral last week for the Navy SEAL team member. Huge service, 1,500 people there, but his dog wandered over to his coffin and lay beside it. So if you haven't seen it, and if you're not too much the weepy type, I can usually search for that online. It's a pretty poignant scene. From Wired Science comes this headline. Human brains are primarily wired to notice animals. Surrounded by technology and urbanity, though we may be, the human brain remains profoundly hardwired to respond to animals. When people are shown pictures of animals, specific parts of the brain, including the structure central to pleasure and pain, fear and reward, react almost instantly. Put another way, glimpsing a bird at the feeder, or a shark on an animal planet, or even a plant kitten, could invoke cognitive tricks inherited from ancestors who walked on four legs in shallow water. This effect is large and consistent and, quote, may reflect the importance that animals held throughout our evolutionary past, wrote researchers led by California Institute of Technology neurobiologist Florian Moorman in an August 29th Nature Neuroscience paper. But Talking Animals listeners and others knew that anyway, kind of, didn't they? At least instinctively. From the AP comes this unfortunate story. Grizzly bear kills man in Yellowstone National Park. Wildlife rangers are trying to capture a grizzly bear in Yellowstone after he killed a hiker in the second fatal bear attack this summer at the national park. The body of John Wallace, 59, was discovered on Friday in a remote area known for its high population of bears. An autopsy concluded he died from injuries sustained in a bear attack. After a fatal mauling last month, the first inside the increasingly crowded park in 25 years, authorities let the responsible grizzly go because it was protecting its cubs. This time, rangers have set traps with the intent to capture and kill the bear that attacked Wallace. Its guilt will be established through DNA analysis connecting it to evidence found at the mauling scene, park officials said. We know of no witnesses to the park, Park Superintendent Dan Wink said on Monday. We're going to err on the safe side of caution since we'll never really know the circumstances in this case. Wallace's death was the fourth caused by grizzlies in the greater Yellowstone area in the last 2 years. Despite the killings, park officials said the rate of dangerous encounters is extremely low, given that more than 3 million people visit the park every year. Locally, event coming up. It's the Greyhound Support Transport Fall Picnic, Sunday, October 2nd at Eagle Lake Park, 1800 Keene Road, Shelter 2 in Largo. It's going to take place from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's for you and your four-legged friends. There'll be a barbecue, silent auction, raffle, and a few extra surprises. And all funds raised will benefit Greyhound Support Transport and moving retired greyhounds to non-racing states. So if you think you'd like to go to this, they are looking for RSVPs just so they make sure they have enough food on hand. So you can do that by email to greyhoundsupporttransport@gmail.com, or Greyhound Support Transport does have a Facebook page at which you, I'm told, can respond as well. Also coming up, our friends at Florida Voices for Animals, as we mentioned before, are gearing up to present the second annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest, which will be October 15th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Cotenchobe Fort Brooke Park in downtown Tampa in honor of World Farm Animals Day. The park is located behind the St. Pete Titans Forum on the Hillsborough River. Mission, well, again, we can't give the cost on air to anything, really, but could not be more reasonable, shall we say, the admission price. There'll be educational exhibits and events, activities for children, companion animals on leashes, of course, are welcome. The event will include healthy living and eco-friendly exhibitors, nationally known and local speakers, nonprofits, fun and games for kids, dog and cat adoptions, restaurant booths with delicious veg food, and live music and entertainment. And speaking of speakers, just found out that one of them that they've got lined up is Carol Leifer, the really great comedian and writer. Her book came out a couple years ago, was When You Lie About Your Age, The Terrorists Win. We had her on Talking Animals in about, a couple years ago. Definitely 2009 sometime. But anyways, written for Saturday Night Live, Letterman, all kinds of sitcoms, including Modern Family, one of the more celebrated sitcoms on the air at the moment. Anyway, and her story is just full of all kinds of her life stories, took all kinds of change. She was never really an animal person growing up, and even as an adult, and then switched, and now is a huge, huge animal nut, with living with several dogs and other animals, I believe, and switched from carnivore, lifelong carnivore, to vegan in recent years, and just, you know, lots of changes. And she's a great, great speaker. She's a great comic. I've heard her speak at a lot of animal events as well. It's fantastic. So that's part of the second annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest. Mark your calendar for October 15th. Find out more information at tampabayvegfest.org. All right, let's step now. We're going to get into some, we'll save some more of these news items for later in the show, and we'll have more time, I'm fairly confident. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. One of our strongest pieces this year has been Bill Burr's Letterman set, talking about he and his girlfriend adopting a pit bull. Last week, he returned to Letterman with a new set that included something of an update on living with and learning about that dog. So this is Bill Burr with a piece I'm calling Dogs Mirror Emotions on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
So now my girl's right. I have to work on my temper, you know? It's screwing up the dog. It is. We rescued a pit bull, which is basically like owning like a teenage lion, you know? And I didn't realize that dogs, like, they feed off your vibes. Like, if you're chilling, they're chilling. If you're sleeping, they're sleeping. But if you're a psycho like me, and you're screaming at the ref on TV, like, you gotta be kidding me! I didn't realize the dog was over in the corner being like, yeah, you gotta be kidding me. Yeah, so I've been working with this trainer. He's teaching me all this stuff. Like, I didn't even realize, even if you play with him, when you bring that energy up, you gotta bring it back down again. I had no idea. Like, I love wrestling with my dog, right? Put her in a front face lock, I'm sweeping her front legs, you know? We're having a great time. But I never noticed that game 7 look she was getting on her face. So then I'd get tired and be like, all right, let's go for a walk. We're going outside. Mentally, I'm chilling, but mentally, the dog is like walking through the tunnel at the Rose Bowl, like, this is what we played for! Somebody hit somebody! All right, I'm going to talk to you about that.
That was, indeed, Bill Burr with a piece I'm calling Dogs Mirror Emotions, taken from his Letterman set last week. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Michael Hinkson. As I touched on earlier, Michael is the author of the new book, Thunderdog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. It's partly about Hinkson, blind since birth, working in the Twin Towers on 9/11, and being led to safety from the 78th floor by his guide dog, at the time, Roselle. But that saga is also deftly fused with a memoir that's really no less fascinating. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Michael Hinkson to Talking Animals. Michael!
Good morning.
Good morning. I should actually probably say welcome back. I think it was 2004 that when we had the show in a whole nother location that you also were kind enough to join us. So thanks for making the time to join us again today.
I'm glad to be here and glad to chat for a while.
Great. Well, me too. So I've mentioned earlier in the show, as well as in, you know, some Facebook posts and elsewhere, that in the coming days, of course, there will be all sorts of ways to mark the 10-year anniversary of 9/11. But talking to you about your book, I think, is likely to stand among the more interesting, distinctive ways. But in fact, before we delve into to your 9/11 story, I'd really like to kind of discuss a little bit your life story, which in the book you've kind of intertwined with recounting the Twin Tower tale, and at times, really, I think it's no less compelling. They really sort of buttress each other. So let's maybe start when you were a kid, specifically a blind since birth kid, riding his bike around the neighborhood on his own. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, probably need to start by defining some concepts. Basically, what I say in the book, which people have a hard time accepting naturally, is blindness isn't the handicap I face. The handicap are the attitudes and misconceptions that people have about blindness and their presumption that because you can't see, you can't do stuff, and that things that they believe only can be done by people who have eyesight are not, in fact, only done by people who have eyesight. Blind people do them, too, and one happens to be riding a bicycle. Now, I'm probably not going to go get a job as a messenger in New York City riding around with a on a bike with messages and things to deliver. But where I lived in Palmdale, California, it was rural, and there were few enough cars that it was easy for me to learn to ride a bike. And, of course, I just used sounds that I hear, various kinds of audio cues like you use visual cues, and I was able to ride the bike with no problem at all. But the issue is people think that because I don't have eyesight, I'm helpless, and that's not true. About the fact that people who can see, in fact, you all have your own disability. You're light dependent. You can't function really without having light. You don't learn how to deal with a lack of light in your lives. Thomas Edison invented the electric light bulb so people could go off and see in the dark. But that doesn't mean that you're necessarily any better for it than with what I can do with technology today.
Well, right, and even I think the earlier point about just sort of the kind of chief issue often throughout your life has been, you know, the attitude about you and what you can and cannot do. I mean, just to stick for a moment with the bike story, just because I think it's sort of telling in a lot of ways, and in some ways it encapsulates the whole Michael Hinkson saga in a way, and sort of foreshadows it at the same time. I mean, as your folks, as you talk about in the book, mainstreamed you before that approach or even that term had probably even been sort of, you know, put into use. But I mean, they always sort of expected that you would just do what your brother did and what just any kid would do. So one of the things I love about just what you've noted about the attitude is that when neighbors would call in to complain about seeing you riding your bike around, your dad would get mad, but at them, at the people calling, like, well, you know, sort of how dare you call up and fuss about this?
Yeah. And they got very mad at my dad for letting that blind kid, ride around the neighborhood because it clearly wasn't safe. Well, they didn't think it was safe, but that didn't mean that it wasn't safe. It was safe.
Right, right. And really, you know, sort of getting, in a sense, to know your dad that way partly prepared us for the man who then reacted the way he did when you were told you could no longer ride the school bus. Maybe you could sort of describe a little bit about that that episode.
Well, I was in high school with my first guide dog, and the superintendent of the school decided that he was going to enforce a rule that the school district had that said no live animals allowed on school buses. Well, there was a state law that said that guide dogs could ride on any public conveyance, including common carriers, of which the school bus is legally one. But the superintendent was absolutely adamant. We took it to a board meeting. He pushed hard, and so the board supported him 3-2, that I couldn't take my guide dog on the bus. How discriminatory can you get? Well, it ended up going to Sacramento. My father, who was the defending our side, took the case to the governor, and it was amazing. All of a sudden, all we know is one day the superintendent was called to Sacramento, and when he came back, I was back on the bus.
Yeah, it's funny how those things work. But again, it was just sort of, you know, your dad was like, instead of just seething at this, I mean, he fought it, and he kept fighting it up through the governor. And as you kind of note, I mean, it's not that he was a particularly educated man, but he said, you know what, I'm going to dive into this, and whatever legal books and other things I need to master to beat this thing, that's what I'm going to do.
You know, I think the message there, and it's a message that comes through often in my book, is we can do more than we think we can as human beings. Mm-hmm. We're oftentimes forced to go out of our comfort zone, as my father, in a sense, had to do.
Sure.
With going into the law in 9/11. But the fact is that we all work together. We all need to recognize that we're an inclusive world. Even back then, when the word wasn't even really around, but the fact is that we are an inclusive world, and we really should be a lot more tolerant of things that we don't necessarily understand.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you got so many messages of that very kind from your folks and really just from, you know, your family and just growing up that, you know, I don't think it, you know, that you just had any, you know, that you were wired any other way as you advanced through, you know, childhood and college and adulthood and beyond. So let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, we're speaking with Michael Hingson, author of the new book, Thunder Dog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Michael a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So, I think we, before we get too far, from your childhood bike riding and into maybe 9/11 and some other stuff, I think we should note a couple other forms of locomotion in which, you've also been behind the wheel that maybe not necessarily everybody listening would expect. Starting with your college, you know, activities.
Well, of course, what you're talking about is that I, did some driving around UC Irvine, and had a parade of the UCI police and other stuff following us because everyone thought it was cute. And I had somebody in the passenger seat who was directing me.
Sure.
But, you know, let's talk about technology again.
Okay.
I talked about the fact that the electric light was invented so that you light-dependent people could see in the dark, and now everyone takes it for granted. Well, here's another one. Earlier this year, the National Federation of the Blind, in conjunction with Virginia Tech University, performed down at the Daytona Speedway, an interesting exhibition for people. Right before the Rolex 24, a blind person stepped into a car and then literally, without any outside information, people, radios or anything, but strictly independently, drove the car around the Daytona Speed Course, including going through obstacle courses and other things like that, because technology is now gone to the point where the camera, video sensing capability of technology and so on has gotten to the point where people are able to create enough information so that a blind person truly independently could drive the car. Now, it's not ready to go off on city streets and so on, but the day is going to come when blind persons will be able to independently drive a car just like a sighted person can.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a question of advances that we make.
Sure.
And, you know, people are going to say, well, yeah, but you had to use this technology. Well, excuse me, you have to use the technology to turn on lights. You know, go away. We all have gifts. We all have capabilities, and we augment those gifts. Technology is a gift that we've all been given to be able to do that. So it's no different for me than for you in one way or another. Technology is allowing us to hear and talk to each other across the country, basically at the speed of light. So the fact is that I did it. I had help. Mark Riccobono did it earlier this year, and he didn't.
Right.
But he did. He had help in the sense that other people developed the technology.
Sure. And again, I think just staying for this with this theme for one more moment then, you know, because again, I'm sure the technology is, you know, sort of right on par. The fact that you also have flown a plane, again, there may come a time where at least, you know, some portion of that, if not most or all of that, will also be served by the kind of technology where that will make that less, you know, less
well,
of a...
it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, on the
okay.
larger jets and so on, they've
right.
actually done demonstrations where planes have taken off and landed themselves. Do I want to fly a plane and be a pilot? No, don't need to do that.
Yeah.
But the technology is there, and certainly more will come that will make that happen.
Sure. So, okay, well, there's lots more of your story
yeah.
that's fascinating and often colorful and I think really informative, and I want to circle back around to some of that in a few moments, but I'm just not sure it's fair to hold off any longer and sort of in discussing 9/11, what 9/11 was like for you. Maybe you could sort of pick up the narrative and start by telling us what had happened in your life and career that involved your working in the North Tower on that day.
For my professional life, I've been involved in high-tech sales and sales management. So in 1999, I was hired by a company to open an office in New York City. Most of the work that had heretofore been done by the company was through distribution and other channels. It was a Fortune 500 company, Quantum Corporation. On the 1st of August in 2000, I opened an office for Quantum on the 78th floor of Tower 1 of the World Trade Center. I was in that building. We were getting ready to do a special training seminar series that day. I was in my office on September 11th, 2001, when the terrorists attacked. with me in my specific office was David Frank, a colleague from our corporate office in California. In our conference room were the early arrivals for the seminars. And so, of course, the building shuddered and shook and tipped, and we thought we were going to fall to the street. Of course, a 78-floor plunge, and that didn't happen. But then my colleague David saw fire and smoke above us, and immediately we certainly knew we had to get out. There was a lot of panic of people running toward the exits and so on, and I told David, slow down, we got to get people out, but we got to do it in an orderly way, because I had a piece of information that no one else was looking at that told me that we didn't need to panic in our evacuation efforts at that time. The information I had was the fact that I had my guide dog, Roselle, with me. I had been standing in the doorway while the building was tipping, and then moved back into my office and met her coming out from under my desk where she had been asleep after the building became vertical again.
Mm-hmm.
I told her to heel, which in guide dog parlance is come around on my left side and sit. She had done that. She was wagging her tail and yawning, and you know, what woke me up here? And then when David saw the fire and smoke and debris falling outside the window, and I heard debris falling outside the window, I wasn't smelling smoke. And obviously Roselle wasn't either. I mean, you certainly told stories and read about humans that were rescued by their dogs who detected some sort of disaster in the making before they did, like fires in buildings and so on. Roselle
sure.
wasn't indicating to me that she had any urgency in her life. And so the result was that I was able to get people to focus. We got them to the stairs. Of course, main reason being is there was fire, so you don't use elevators.
Sure.
And we got them going down the stairs, and then Roselle and I and David left, and we started down the stairs as well, and then eventually made it out.
Sure. Well,
Roselle and I worked as a team. I focused on keeping her calm and telling her that we were okay, and that that I wasn't nervous, and in turn, her guiding was flawless, which told me that she wasn't detecting anything that made her nervous. So the two of us worked together.
Sure. Well, again, from what you kind of described there and recount, I mean, it was really her calm, as you say, initially, that kind of gave you that key piece of information to then proceed calmly and probably help David, you know, remain calm similarly. And you obviously, and Roselle did, of course, work as a team. One of the things I guess I was struck by in your account, too, was that you and Roselle had at that point only been working together 21 months, I think it was, and you know, that piece of information might be more meaningful in the context that, as you explain in the book, it usually takes at least a year or so for kind of a guide dog partnership to click, to gel. So, you know, with that kind of framework in mind, I mean, this was still kind of a relatively new partnership.
Yeah, it was a fairly new relationship, but we'd worked together well enough that we knew each other pretty well. Dogs are open to trust. People really ought to be as open as dogs are. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to just arbitrarily trust without earning trust. But by the same token, we had worked together long enough that we knew each other pretty well.
And so what's so there you and Roselle and David are kind of making your way down from the 78th floor. And and again, as I mentioned in the kind of the introduction, I mean, one of the things that I really, you know, love about the book is that, you know, that is a huge part of the book, of course, but it's really interwoven with other parts of your life story. So it's, you know, really kind of you get the sense of urgency and it's compelling. And then there's stuff that's unrelated to 9/11 at all that again, at times I found equally compelling. I mean, one of the things though is really you and Roselle were really, really in sync and did have that trust that you mentioned and that connection. And then along the way, you know, people of course are also exiting and people are sometimes running past you in some cases in both directions. And one of the things that kind of I think hooks back into what you said sort of in the beginning of our conversation is that at one point you meet up with a firefighter in the stairwell. And, you know, he is obviously, you know, responding to this, but noticing obviously that, you know, that you were there with a guide dog, he's, you know, almost kind of peeved that you weren't sort of, you know, accepting the help he was offering and kind of insistently offering eventually.
I'm sorry, do that last part again.
Just kind of talking about the firefighter that you met
right,
in
okay.
the stairwell.
Well, actually met a whole string of firefighters, and it happened to be the first one. Of course, he came up and asked if I was okay, and then he said, we're going to send somebody down the stairs with you, and I resisted that for the reasons we talked about earlier, but mainly I resisted it because I didn't need help getting down the stairs. I didn't want to take a fireman out of their position in line and doing the work that they were doing to get me down the stairs and then find out later that somebody had been killed or injured because somebody wasn't where they were supposed to be. And the fact is that I'm just as capable of going down the stairs as you. And so we worked at it, and finally I had to use the last card available, which was I was already with a friend who could see, don't worry about us.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I understand why people feel the way they do, but the reality is blindness isn't the handicap. Eyesight's the disability or the handicap that I face.
Sure, sure.
So the fireman, though, petted Roselle, and she gave him kisses, and he was petting her, and, of course, it wasn't the time to give him a lecture, don't pet a guide dog in harness.
Right.
But you know, again, they went upstairs and did what they needed to do, and probably those kisses from Roselle was the last unconditional love he ever got in his life.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, in sort of, you know, writing the book and obviously thinking about that day and in writing the book and then, you know, now talking about the book, I mean, what does 9/11 mean to you nearly a decade later and how have your feelings about it changed over these 10 years, if they have?
It's a day of remembrance, I think. It's a day that's going to always be part of our history. It's a day that reflects the worst in humanity and also even more so the best in humanity. You know, Thunderdog is all about teamwork. It's all about trust. It's all about people working together and people and dogs working together to do something that needed to be done and, I guess, in a sense, do something great, get a bunch of people out of the World Trade Center. It's a story about me as a blind person being able to be successful and growing up in spite of all that went on around me and dealing with adversity and trying to make this a more inclusive society. And all those things are part of 9/11. I think that 9/11 was a day that showed that people could work together and be unified and survive something that was incredibly horrific. I don't think that my perception and my thoughts have changed over the years. I think that they've sort of gelled into this is really a day that we should use to learn lessons. Lessons were offered to us on 9/11 about working together, about inclusion, about what we can do when we're pushed to do something that we didn't expect that we would have to do. And I think that if anything comes out of 9/11, I would hope that people would change and be willing to take greater stands on things that happened in their lives. As I talked about in the book, there was a time that I was led to really accept the adage, don't worry about what I couldn't control. In the case of 9/11, focus on working with Roselle and running with Roselle, and the rest would take care of itself. We do have things in our lives that we can control. We don't think we can, and so as a result, we lose that control. No matter what change happens to us, no matter what occurs that we really didn't have control over, we always have control over how we perceive it and how we move forward from it, how we think about it. We always have a lot more control, I think, than we believe that we do. It's something that we need to work on is taking more control over our lives. And certainly right now we're in a country where our political leaders are clueless. All of them. They're not governing. They're not being sensible. And it is time that we send stronger messages than ever that if you guys are going to be the ones that we pay to run the government, you better start working together and you better start recognizing that there's a lot more support and a lot more value in teamwork. Otherwise, we're going to take action and get elected other people who will do a better job.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's food for thought and food for comment. I just, again, want to let people know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Michael Hinkson, author of the new book, Thunderdog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And, in fact, Michael, one of our emailers, it might hook right into sort of the last part of the comment you just made. The subject line says 9/11 service request from President Obama, and the email itself reads, the president requested that people commemorate 9/11 by offering at least 72 hours of public service. What particular volunteer work would your guest like to see people make, and what does he feel would help them understand and relate to his experience?
Well, of course, I'm prejudiced. Go volunteer at one of the guide dog schools. Be puppy raisers. Go do some work there. But I think it goes beyond that. I would say volunteer at Big Brothers and Big Sisters organizations, at organizations for the homeless. Bring help get food for people who need it. In general, we need to address some issues in our own country, and it does probably come down to entitlement programs to a degree. You know, we do a lot of aid overseas, but we have some challenges in our country as well. Examples: over 70% of all employable blind people in this country are unemployed, and that's not because blind people can't work; it's because we're not given the opportunity. The Gallup Polling Organization has done studies that show that one of the top five fears that we have in this country is blindness. Not disabilities, but blindness. 76% of all people fear blindness over any other disability. And so what do? We run from it. So I think that it would certainly be appropriate for people to take some real quality quiet time and reflect on our own lives and reflect how we might change to become more inclusive, and that's why I suggested some of the things that I just suggested.
Sure.
Because we all need to recognize there are some people who are certainly more fortunate than us, and those people need to recognize that there are people who are less fortunate, and all of us can find people who are worse off than we. But, you know, there are lots of ways that we can help. And it may just be saying hello to someone. It may be visiting a hospital, or it may be helping to get food. Those are all not just trivial things. Oh, I'm going to do that, or I'll get around to doing that. The reality is, I believe that we are all responsible for each other in some way, and that we are certainly responsible for helping others in our society, or at least asking if they need help. You know, somebody may say, no, I don't need your help. And a lot of people come up and grab me when I'm at a street corner and they want to hustle me across the street and I don't even want to go that way. I have no problem with someone coming up to me and saying, do you need help? But I also expect them to respect it if I say, nope, we're good.
Yeah.
Even if it turns out that I made a mistake, I have to learn from that. We
sure.
all need to learn from our life experiences. And so people also need to be strong enough to say, you said you didn't need help, so, you know, that's okay.
Right. And the key thing there is that it's your call.
It should be my call.
Right.
But I think that we all can help each other and serve each other in so many ways because we are all in this country together. Go volunteer in a humane society or animal shelter or SPCA. Help all those animals that just plain get left on the side of the road or whatever.
Yeah.
They deserve a life too.
Sure. Well, so Michael, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, you know, one of the things I was struck by in the book and that you mentioned a moment ago too, about this, I think kind of really, staggering statistic that of employable, and I think that's the kind of key phrase I think here, of blind people, that the unemployment rate is near 70%. And I also kind of want to, perhaps hook this given how accomplished you are and all the things you've done professionally and some things you've been saying in this interview, I think people listening might be surprised to hear that you write in the book at one point, the truth is I face discrimination every day. And I guess one of the things is, do you feel that that's improving, that we're improving, that that's getting better?
Sometimes I do, and sometimes I don't. The reality is that we haven't truly changed our views about disabilities in general, much less blindness. The ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, mandates some things, but, you know, have we intellectually really changed? We're not there yet. On the day that I can go into a restaurant and consistently find a Braille menu, or when I can go into a restaurant with other people and sit down and the wait staff doesn't say, what does he want?
Mm.
Or on the day I can be part of a company and go into a meeting and they have either provided in Braille or in some sort of electronic form in advance the documentation and the stuff that other people get in the meetings. When that becomes commonplace as us providing Spanish language translated materials and so on, or radio stations and TV stations in Spanish, when the day comes that all that's commonplace, then I'll tell you that it's really changed. But until that day comes, you know, the fact is it hasn't. When I go into a store and the person behind the counter starts shouting, how can I help you? You know, I'm not deaf. I happen to be blind.
Mm-hmm.
So when the day comes when I'm not viewed as something different and sometimes something that no one wants to face because, oh, this could happen to me, and they recognize that there are alternatives, then that'll be the day that I can tell you that we have truly made an improvement in our country and in our social fabric.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about Thunderdog, and I should say it's available everywhere. It's available on all the major online organizations like Barnes & Noble and Amazon and so on. It's available, or should be available, in any bookstore. It has been a New York Times bestseller since it was published. But if people can't get it any other way, or as an incentive, if they'd like to get the book with my autograph and, more important, Roselle's potograph, we got her paw print 6 days before she died, people can go to www.michaelhingson.com. MichaelHingson.com. That's the only place where you're going to get autographed and potographed books. So we do have it for sale.
And that's how I got mine. And yeah, that was sort of the first time we had acknowledged that.
Yeah,
sadly that Roselle, you know, had unfortunately passed away. But I think a lot of what you've said in this interview, you know, I'm not here to hawk your book particularly, except just to let people know that it's available. But I mean, I do think there's so much in there. Again, like I've mentioned a few times now, it's woven in and out of the, you know, recounting the whole 9/11 experience. But there's so much there that I think is really, really valuable. Because I think, you know, everybody has their own sort of threshold of what they know and don't know, whether it's, of course, I think a lot of people listening would know not to go up and pet a service dog, guide dog, while it's, you know, in its harness or working. And I think a lot of us, hopefully I would know not to yell at a blind person when they see them walk in. But even a few little things that you had in there about, you know, that made me more subtle, like, you know, I might have been, until I read your book, a little self-conscious about using words like see, did you see this, or that. And you make a point of saying, don't worry about that. I use those words too, and that's, you know, that's in fact part of being more inclusive and bringing us all together. So
the dictionary defines see as to perceive, so, you know, there's no problem.
Right, but I guess I just meant that even as someone who's trying to be a little more plugged in and aware,
I
was, you know, probably a little self-conscious about that until I read your book. So I just think there's just so many things on so many levels that we can all really learn and make the situation better and make that discrimination, you know, reduced over time. So
if I might, the American Humane Association has a hero dogs contest where they are trying to find the hero dog of the year. This is the first annual one, and they expect to do this regularly, I guess, in the future. Roselle is one of 8 finalists, and people can go vote for her by going to www.herodogawards.org, www.herodogawards.org. And forget those other dogs, just vote for Roselle. You can vote once a day, and we hope that people will vote for Roselle, who truly was a hero that deserves the accolades. Even though she has passed, she is eligible, and I think that it's a great way to help honor her memory as well as what happened on 9/11. So we hope people will do that. We have also started a foundation called the Roselle's Dream Foundation that we're raising money to provide more education about blindness, but also technology that we use is very expensive. And so we're going to use funds as we raise enough to help provide scholarships to offset some of the technology costs for children and adults as we get enough funds to do it. So we're pretty excited about that.
That's fantastic. Well, Michael, we have reached the end of our time, but I really, really appreciate you making the time to join us today again on Talking Animals. And just as a reminder, the name of the book is Thunder Dog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero, as Michael notes, available wherever you would normally get books. But
wherever
again,
books are sold.
Wherever books are sold. But also, again, if you do want it signed by Michael and with the autograph, so to speak, from Roselle, then you can go to Michael Hingson, HingSon.com. And again, if you want to vote for Roselle, who certainly I think has really earned your vote, and then some, you can go to HeroDogAwards.org. Thank you so much.
Vote often.
That's right. Thank you so much, Michael, and good luck, and we'll speak to you again, down the road.
Do it again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Okay. I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize, a copy of Michael Hingson's book, Thunder Dog, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Okay, looks like we got a lot of folks who think they can name that animal tune. We'll take them in the order they came. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Yeah, Black Cow.
Absolutely, and of course you probably know the artist as well.
Yuli Dan.
Yeah, there you go. What is your first name, sir?
Mike.
Mike?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Well, Mike, you are going to get yourself a copy of Michael Hingson's book, Thunder Dog, The True Story of a Blind Man, His Guide Dog, and the Triumph of Trust at Ground Zero. I'm going to put you back on hold, get your address, and send you off that copy. Thanks for listening.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, folks, we do have a winner. And so I think what we're going to do now is get back to some... a few more of these news items, some of which I've had to carry over for a couple weeks now, including this one. Sometimes, you know, I'm just not sure exactly what PETA has going on. Because now they're planning a porn site. Story came, I think, from CBS Online. The animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, is raising eyebrows with plans to launch a pornography website. The site will take advantage of the new .xxx top-level domains. PETA.xxx will be a hub for sexually explicit content and, weirdly enough, animal abuse. According to the Herald Sun spokeswoman, Ashley Bernstein, we are preparing to launch our own PETA.xxx site, but instead of just showing people our iconic ads, we then show them how animals suffer for entertainment. And, so anyway, if you have any thoughts or comments on that, there you go. Sure it made sense at one point along the line. I'm just surprised it advanced that far enough to actually do it, but that's what it makes for a difference of opinion. Anyway, another heads up on something coming down the road here that's important to those of us that have enough of music and love animal lovers, by which I mean Harry Hayward is just a great guy, terrific local musician, and big animal guy, true supporter of Talking Animals and the Talking Animals Festival, played at both festivals, and he's facing a medical challenge, and as with so many great musicians, not covered by health insurance. So there's a benefit in the works, scheduled for November 6th at Skipper's, and among those performing are Ronnie Elliott and the Nationals, Dirty Spoons at Trash, Chroma, Crash Mitchell 5, Roger Stone's Band, Florida Mountain Boys. So mark your calendar. It's November 6th at Skipper's. You can find out more or other ways you can maybe help out by going simply to helphayward, HAYWARD.com. And otherwise, let's see. I think there was something I saw. New York, a pack of junkyard dogs is roaming the sidewalks surrounding the New York Mets City Field, menacing visitors as they exit the ballpark. Quote, they came to me like a locomotive. Elaine Furick told the New York Post, describing her encounter this month with a 70-pound pit bull and shepherd mix that looked like a wolf. My friend, who's terrified of dogs, ran for her life faster than I've ever seen her run before, Furick told the paper. I stood there and the dog rammed into me like a battering ram. Amazingly, I did not go down. The stray dogs have been wandering across 126th Street from Willis Point, No Man's Land of auto body shops, and onto the stadium grounds for years, stadium security guards told the paper. A spokesperson for the team said that it has been made aware of the dogs, and they have reached out to the appropriate agencies to address the matter. Maybe they're just baseball fans, these dogs. All right, I think we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals. We'll be back next Wednesday, September 7th. At 11 a.m., when our guest will be Jonathan Balcom, author of the new book, The Exultant Ark, A Pictorial Guide of Animal Pleasure. Gorgeous, wonderful book that addresses and captures various forms of animal happiness. Nice to get something fun and upbeat in the animal world sometimes when they hear about some of the things that aren't quite that way. So anyway, that's next Wednesday, September 7th. I hope you'll join me then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals shows. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Have a great and safe Labor Day weekend. Meanwhile, stay tuned, of course, for the fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls version of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. In this case, yet another one recommended by Leo Demski, host of the terrific Café du Monde. Tuesdays from 3 to 4 p.m. here on WMNF. Leo Show features wonderful world music, and this is Chinese folk music from a band called Hangai, with beautiful Mongolian Horse taking us up to the NPR News, and then Scott Elliott and his great, great show right here on WMNF Tampa. We'll see you next Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. After 3 months of mounting job loss,